we believe that with a single family residential home model, we can essentially recreate home. I think home is not just a physical construct, it's a social construct. Home is a state of mind. It's about how you feel about a place and what's happening in that place. And so what's really great about these homes is you kind of live in them as you would in your own home, and you do the things that you would do in your own home.
Thanks for listening to Bridge the Gap, a podcast dedicated to informing, educating, and influencing the future of housing and services for seniors. This show is powered by our sponsors, Align, NICMAP, ProCare HR, Sage, Gibson Insurance, Hamilton CapTel, Paragon Senior Living, ServiceMaster, The Bridge Group Construction, Salinity, and produced by Grit and Gravel Marketing. Connect with the BTG Network team and use your voice to influence the industry at btgvoice.com.
All right, Bridge the Gap, 3, 2. Welcome to Bridge the Gap Podcast, the senior living podcast with Josh and Lucas. A beautiful day here in San Diego, California, and we are off and running here at Senior Living 100. We have a great guest on today. We want to welcome George Koutenarian, co-founder and president and CEO of WellPoint. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks, George, for the work you guys do.
Well, thank you. We're excited to have you on to talk about residential care homes. That's what we're going to be diving into. You and Josh are actually on a speakers panel today, tomorrow actually, to talk about bespoke models, right? Things that are not your standard cookie cutter, regular, 80 bed AL, right? That's on every corner in America. Residential care homes are really emerging. I think there's a lot of different talking points. Bring us into the fold. Number one, how did you even get interested in senior housing and specifically residential care homes?
Yeah, so a little bit about WellPoint. We operate 67 communities in California across Fresno, Los Angeles, Irvine, and Mission Viejo. And they're all residential assisted living. So they, in California, that basically entails 6 residents or less per location. And so we really position them as boutique residential assisted living communities that have like an intimate feel. We also specialize in care coordination. That's really important for us. But the way we started, so my sister's my co-founder, but our parents started in 1984 with a single home. And so then, over time in 2013, we came back and started working with them side by side. And then about 5, 6 or so years ago, we kind of fully took over the legacy organization, rebranded it as WellPoint, and went from about, I think at the time was about 12 locations to 67 now, making us the largest operator in this particular segment.
67 residential care homes. That's incredible. What has that been like to scale at that size?
There's, a couple key ingredients. I think you have to have the right team. So really bringing top quality people into the organization, a combination of people from within the industry, but a lot of people from outside the industry as well. And then technology has been really key. So people are talking about AI a lot, and rightfully so. But, for us, technologically, the first thing was the IoT revolution, so Internet of Things. And so this whole concept of a smart home, well, we really had to embrace that and lean into that so that we can scale, these smaller kind of fragmented locations. But really, I think the customer value proposition is also really key for us, is the concept of a home. So we know from research, 85% of older adults want to live at home as long as possible. So we're not here trying to resist that fact or be in conflict with it. We're actually embracing it and basically providing an option that's as close to home as you can get.
Well, so I have so many questions. I imagine when you do something, especially when you scale something that is not extremely common, there's going to be challenges as well as great benefits. And obviously, I'm sure you've experienced both. So starting on the challenge side, what have been some of the biggest obstacles for you scaling a platform like this?
Yeah, I think the first thing was, so you need capital. And I think on the capital side, educating the lender community, educating the banks and the private credit lenders, they look at it from the outside and they're like, well, okay, it looks like a home, like residential, but then on the inside, it appears that there's a business. And so is it residential or is it commercial? And so these were early conversations 5-6 years ago that I was having with commercial banks. So a lot of education up front. And now we're at a point where we have some, you know, big institutional lenders that support what we do and believe in our mission and us as operators. And so that's, I think, you know, without the capital, it's really hard. And then the other thing is, again, just operationally, the fragmentation of it, being able to use technology, looking at technologies that aren't even geared for our industry. So we don't wait for, you know, a technological solution in the space come to us and say, hey, we're built for senior living or whatever. We actually go outside the industry to find solutions because we aren't that kind of standard box, if you will. So a lot of the standard solutions in the industry don't actually work for our model.
That makes sense. So is it the same on the capital provider side? Are you going to traditional capital providers and lenders that are already in the senior living community space, or are these fund sources outside of senior housing?
On the lender side for debt, we're going, it's within the industry. But it required a lot of education. But now the product, from our perspective, is accepted within the industry. So much so that there's a panel on this whole model at NIC coming up as well. So so finally, it's getting attention. But we've been kind of building that education and proof of concept since, you know, with the lender community in the space since 2021.
How do you, you've obviously grown really quickly. Mm-hmm. How do you identify the markets or the neighborhoods or whatever you're going into? Is that sort of a ground up new construction, or is this acquiring existing homes and converting them into care homes?
So first, in terms of the type of home, we really look for a median priced home, median plus maybe. And that's not by accident. I mean, statistically, most people will relate to the median. That's what the median, right? It's the middle point. And so that resonates with a broader swath of people. So, you know, you don't want to do a low end home. You don't want to do, we're not targeting luxury home either. So that's first and foremost. So a relatable product, and then a neighborhood that can bring in, can serve as many people as possible. So something, again, doesn't, it's not like necessarily a high end neighborhood, but it's something, again, mid price point, right? So that type of neighborhood. And in terms of what we do with the home, we haven't done ground up yet. These are basically adaptive reuse. So we'll take the home that meets our profile. It could be 3 to 4 bedrooms starting. We'll take it down to the studs, and then we'll expand it, do an addition, take it to 6 bedrooms. And then generally we'll go from like 2 to 3 bathrooms to 4 to 5 bathrooms. Some residents can have private bathrooms as well. But our standard model is to have all private rooms. So that's kind of out of the box. Part of our value proposition is we want everyone to have a private room because we believe that's what consumers value.
And I think you said in California, the maximum number of residents you can have is 6.
It's the maximum if you would like to do the homes as of right. So basically, if we don't want to go through conditional use permitting or zoning variances, then 6 is the limit. If you go beyond 6, then, you know, the land use piece kind of changes and it gets a little more complicated.
Have you found resistance in some of the neighborhoods you go to that, you know, some of the neighbors are like, hey, we don't know if we want this use in our neighborhood?
If they're not as familiar, sometimes it's more about fear of the unknown. So it's really about kind of educating, showing that you're good neighbors. So we really take great care of the homes. You know, the lawns are beautiful, you know, fresh paint, we replace roofs. So, I mean, we really, you know, in a typical home, you know, we're putting in, when we do our adaptive reuse, we're generally putting in $400,000 to $500,000 into a home to purpose redevelop it to meet the needs of, you know, aging adults.
What does staffing look like in a model like this?
Out of the box, at a minimum, you have 1 staff to 6 residents at all times. So that's just minimum out of the box, which is superior to a lot of other types of settings. And then oftentimes we'll have 2 residents most of the time during the day. And in some cases, it can even be 3, just depending on what the needs are. And then we have a staff person who stays on site overnight.
I would imagine, I mean, so most states have some category of licensure like this, but it doesn't seem like there's high use of that category. Have you found challenges with regulators not really even understanding the model really well and being able to regulate it.
Well, in California, interestingly, whether you're 6 beds or 100 beds, you're actually under the same licensure type.
Oh, wow.
Now, there are some delineations on how things operate depending on where you are with number of beds. So in California, there's kind of different bed thresholds. So like I think over 15 is one. I think over 49 is another. I think 99 is another. So there's just different thresholds, but it's all within the same universe of regulations and it's all within the same licensure type.
Well, that's interesting. So, you know, some of the challenges, I'm sure, and we could talk for a long time about those, but what about the benefits? Obviously, you're passionate about this for more than just the real estate play.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, we could do bigger footprint facilities of communities if we wanted to.
Sure.
We choose, you know, we're intentionally choosing this model.
Why is that?
Yeah. But
you obviously feel that this is a great quality model for the resident.
I think it's resonating with consumers because, again, like I said, 85% of older adults want to live in their current home as long as possible. And so, in order to resonate with that, we don't want to resist that. We want to embrace that fact. And we believe that with a single family residential home model, we can essentially recreate home. I think home is not just a physical construct. It's a social construct. Home is a state of mind. It's about how you feel about a place and what's happening in that place. And so what's really great about these homes is you kind of live in them as you would in your own home, and you do the things that you would do in your own home. So like, as an example, we just got a message over the weekend about a resident, his name's Vince, and their staff were like, Vince wants to do a yard sale in the front yard. His brother brought a bunch of his stuff over and Vince wants to sell it and do a yard sale. And that was the first time anyone asked us about doing a yard sale. So we just thought, you know, pause for a second. Like, okay, well, I mean, could I do a yard sale at my own house? I mean, yeah, I can. So why can't Vince? It's Vince's home. So we said, yeah, go ahead. So basically, it was literally like, I think yesterday, Vince did a yard sale in the front yard. So I think it's about being able to create these spontaneous, organic moments as opposed to like manufactured moments. Like, we have planned activities. That's great. But there's a lot of organic things happening in these types of homes. I just recently put a story on my LinkedIn about two of our residents, Jane and Fernando. They both moved into a home at different times, didn't know each other before, both were single, became friends, and then now, you know, they found love. So like, neither of them were probably planning that or expecting that. But in this small kind of six resident environment, you know, it's life. And so we're trying to change the narrative, or what I think is like the misconception in the public about the kind of assisted living industry in general. There's this kind of misconception about assisted living is the beginning of the end. And we're trying to transform that narrative to the beginning of what's next. That this is a place to live. Mm. And that's why we're passionate about it.
So talent acquisition. This is not a traditional senior living community, which is already challenging enough. What have you had challenges on talent acquisition? Like labor, everybody talks about it. You hear operators all over the country. What is your take on that?
Are you talking about more at the direct care level?
That's correct.
Yeah, at the direct care level, I actually think we have a really interesting value proposition because of the higher staff to resident ratios that we have. So I think we're actually an attractive alternative for some people to come and work in a smaller home-like setting with maybe more staff than they're generally accustomed to. So we actually think that, you know, we're becoming an attractive alternative. And so, you know, is it hard? Yeah, it's hard. You know, I think we're navigating it pretty well. We really emphasize benefits and basically trying to turn caregiving from a transient job into a career. So we're trying to do like career laddering and creating so as we grow, there's naturally becoming more opportunities for people to advance in the organization. We also naturally bake overtime into a lot of our shifts, not every single position, but we put overtime in them so that we can kind of generate higher pay. So a lot of folks in the industry will just be like, we're not paying overtime, no overtime. Everything's just an 8-hour shift max because California has daily overtime and weekly overtime and potentially double time. But by creating those types of shifts, even though in theory we can do more optimized shifts that pay out less, it's almost like a recruiting tool. The other thing is our employee advance program. We do advances to really help promote housing security and transportation security. So if we have employees, for example, maybe they have bad credit or no credit. Well, the security deposits for apartments when you have no credit or bad credit is a lot higher than it otherwise would be. So we'll help advance money for apartment deposits, for example, or if they need help with getting a car and they need a down payment for a car and they're going to carpool with other coworkers. Like, we're trying to promote those types of things and not just the standard, like, well, this is your rate of pay. This is what you get paid, you know, helping them solve their challenges.
So you're talking about that Senior Living 100, your model. You're also, I think, maybe doing a talk at NIC about your model. It's not something through the years I've heard a lot of talk about, even though there's in some states, as we've talked about, there's a regulatory category that's just underutilized probably. Do you see in the coming years that this is going to be a more mainstream model that everybody's aware of and talking about and trying to scale?
100%. It's just a matter of time. And it's just a matter of what the operator footprints are going to be. The models are there in the other states too. It's just really fragmented. So what's happening is this, you know, you might have someone, it's a small family business. You know, they might have 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 locations. In California, that's kind of the average, is about 3 to 4 locations is about as big as, you know, an operator will get. So in the mainstream part of the industry, we don't hear about it as much because of all the fragmentation. And so now what's happening is there are certain operators in different states that are starting to emerge with some sense of notable scale. You know, us in California, there's other providers in Colorado, Texas, you know, and others are emerging in other states. And so, and I think as the capital sources get more acquainted with the product and the offering, I think more of that capital will start to flow, and that will help give rise to more availability. Because I think if the capital's not there, we can all want to do it, but I just think it's going to be hard if the capital's not there.
And I would assume it seems like the capital follows the data. And with it being so fragmented, I would imagine there's not a lot of data out there that you can find unless you're obviously aggregating data from your platform now that you have scale. But is that a difficulty you all have found in just finding out data in other states and from other providers?
It's, I think, traditionally been opaque. I think there's becoming increasing transparency with state regulators, and you know, all the states are kind of on this trend of making more things visible. And so I think data is becoming more available, but I think it's still sparse. Like, we don't know, like, occupancy metrics of these smaller communities. We don't necessarily have as much rate data. So, you know, it's not like the, you know, the NICS reporting that they do, the formerly MAP, you know, and those analytics and, you know, those, there's no data sets like that for our industry. But to your point, we are capturing our own data internally with our systems about who we're taking care of, you know, how old they are, you know, what the profile of these residents look like, all these things we are collecting. And so when we're having conversations, we can point to the data.
So I heard you say when you're looking at a market as far as feasibility, you're looking at homes that are sort of in the average.
Yeah.
Is that also where, from affordability standpoint for the consumer, are we talking, is this an average senior living product, or do you pay a premium for this, or is it more affordable? Where do you see this product fitting?
We view it as a market rate product that's designed for affordability, to be accessible. So we do utilize heavily Medicaid waivers. So in California, that'd be Medi-Cal. So we utilize the assisted living waiver. We're working more directly now with managed care plans. So, you know, and I think that's what's made us successful, is that there's this notion of there's a trade-off between, you know, affordability and quality. And so our goal is basically to disrupt that equation. You don't have to make that trade-off. So we do also have private pay, and we're able to command private pay rates, but we try to make the model accessible and really democratize access to everyone. And that also means, you know, becoming more diverse in terms of who we're trying to serve. So our customer base is more, you know, ethnically diverse than it's ever been before. Like one of our markets, for example, Fresno, is 55% Hispanic. So, you know, we've been growing in that segment. Basically, we want the composition of our homes to mirror what the population in the community looks like. We want it to be representative. We don't want to be niche. We want to be more mainstream.
Lucas, this is really exciting. I feel like we have a front row seat to see change happening. And it's been talked about. And I think you're seeing this in Texas and other states that you're working. It's exciting times to be in senior health.
It is. I think, you know, with this demand for older adults that are age and income qualified, and when we look at the NICMAP data, we start to see that occupancy is going to be at max in the next coming years. I think this is a great option, not only to bridge the gap there, but it's just a great option for older adults to have to choose where they want to have home.
Yeah, it's a great option.
We know that you've got a busy schedule here, and this is a great conversation. Thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
To our listeners, you can go to bggvoice.com and download this content and so much more. Thanks for listening to another great episode of Bridge the Gap.